Good evening, everybody. Let's start with our motivation. And think of all the different things you could be doing now. Not only in this realm, in this life, but if you had been born in a different realm with a different kind of life, the different experiences that you could be having right now in the hell realm or hungry ghost realm or animal realm or God realm, wherever. And remember that there's many countless sentient beings experiencing all those different situations right now. But due to previous karma and due to the choices we made today, we have the fortune to be here and be able to listen to the Dharma this evening. So when you think of all the other things that we could be doing and experiencing right now, it's almost miraculous that we have the chance to listen to Aryadeva's 400 stanzas. So since we have this opportunity and other living beings don't at this moment, then let's listen with the thought of learning so we can be of benefit to all these other living beings, so that we can transform our mind and thereby be more capable of being of benefit to all of them. So with this attitude of compassion and of offering service, then let's listen and take in the teachings this evening. I think 2 weeks ago when I was in Wali, we got as far as verse 10, right? So we're going to start from there. And I'm doing a very fast go through these in the hopes that we can go through the first four chapters, the first 100 verses, before Geshe Topke arrives. Okay, so verse 11 says, you would like to live long, but dislike old age. Amazing! Your behavior seems right to people like you. Okay, so here somebody's coming along and says, life consists of a series of brief moments, but since the continuity is uninterrupted, life is actually long. Therefore, attachment to this life is reasonable. Yeah? So, the answer is, if you want to live long, but you dislike old age, it's totally amazing. Yeah. We all want to live long, but who wants to get old? But if you want to live long, you have to get old. Okay. So this is like contradictory, isn't it? So he's saying, your contradictory behavior seems right only to unwise people like you. You know, people who are thinking like this way. Yeah. So since you don't want old age, don't be attached to the continuation of life. Yeah. But we are attached to the continuation of life, aren't we? We don't want to die tomorrow. We don't want to die anytime. But we also don't want to get old. Oh, that puts us in quite a predicament, doesn't it? Yeah. But this is exactly how nonsensical and out of touch with reality our afflictive mind is. It doesn't make sense. Yeah. So the conclusion is, don't be attached to the continuation of this life. That means, at any moment, be ready to let go of the continuation of this life. At any moment, be ready to, abandon this body, abandon this ego identity, abandon everything that's familiar to you, abandon all your dear ones, abandon all your possessions and everything you care about. It's really dramatic, isn't it? I mean, everything we have to abandon and to not be attached to any of it when we die. I mean, that's our goal. And if we're not attached to any of it when we die, then that means to try and overcome the attachment to it when we're alive. And the thing is, if we can overcome the attachment to it, when all that stuff when we're alive, we'll be so much happier right now. And will create so much more, virtuous karma. So it's not like abandoning attachment to this life is going to make our life boring and dull. Quite the opposite. It's going to make it really alive, and our mind won't be flipping out over this, that, and the other thing. You know, all the things we usually flip out about. They didn't say thank you to me. I'm not appreciated. You know, all of our dramas that are so terribly serious. Then verse 12. Why do you grieve at death on account of your children and others? When the one that laments is a victim, how is that not reprehensible? Okay, so here somebody comes along and says, though we don't want to age and die, it's not so bad when it's us that ages and dies. But it's much worse than it happens to you, when it happens to your child. So it's absolutely appropriate to grieve the death of your children and the death of your loved ones. Okay, so the next whole set of verses is like concerning when somebody you really care about dies. Yeah. So, it's saying, why do you grieve at the death on account of your children and others? You know, you're so upset when the people you love die. But the one that laments, that is us, who is a victim, that means we ourselves are subject to the Lord of Death. Okay? So we're grieving and fearful for other people's death, but we're not at all concerned for our own death, even though we're under the influence of afflictions and karma and the whole thing, then how is that not reprehensible? How is that not stupid? You getting what I'm saying? You know, we're so like, oh, but my loved one is dying. That can't happen. And here the example of the child is really strong. So we don't have children. Most of them, yeah, nobody here has children. Yeah. So, but I remember when I was little, my mom saying that she could handle my dad's death and everybody else's death, but if something happened to her kids, she didn't think she could handle that. You know, that I think somehow the attachment to one's children is so strong, you know, because they're part of you. They're your legacy. You know, I'm going to die, but my children are going to live on, so somehow I'm going to live on. So then if that child dies, you know. And also because parents put a lot of hope in their children. You know, they want their children to have all the things they didn't have, to be able to do all the things they couldn't do, you know, to, be the kind of person that they weren't able to be. And so when the child dies, the parent gets very, very upset. And also because it seems like an unnatural sequence, you know. But that happens a lot. It happens a whole lot that children die before parents. Okay? So So Arya Deva here is saying, if it's fitting for you, in other words, us, you know, who does negative things to grieve about dying, why do you grieve others' deaths while neglecting to remember your own? Okay, but here what he's pointing out is we grieve others' deaths not because we're afraid they're going to go to the lower realms because they've created negative karma, and not because we're afraid they won't be liberated or attain, you know, enlightenment. We grieve them for very self-centered reasons. I want to be with them. Yeah. So he's kind of jabbing it. We're grieving others, the loss of others for self-centered reasons. But the fact that we're going, and we can't control their death, but the fact that we're going to die, and the fact that we're under the influence of karma and afflictions, we're totally spaced out about. We don't even care about, you know. And so let alone not care about that for us, we don't even care about it for the people that we say we love so much and we're going to be so upset if they die. Yeah, because that's true, isn't it? When somebody we care about dies, you know, do most people think, oh, I'm afraid of where they're going to be reborn. They didn't have the opportunity to practice the Dharma, and maybe they're going to have a bad rebirth, or maybe they were angry when they were dying, and that upset their, made a negative karma ripen. Do most people think that when a relative dies? No. Most people think, oh, the person I love isn't going to be here. What am I going to do? Yeah. And actually what's happening at that moment is you're grieving for the future. Because the past you already had with the person. The past is over and done with. You can't grieve it because it doesn't exist at this moment. The present is fleeting, going out of existence. So you're not grieving that. What you're grieving is your idea of what the future was supposed to be with this person. But your idea, your expectation is not happening. So you're grieving what never happened. You know, and when you think about it, it's kind of strange the way our mind works, isn't it? You know, we have this idea that I'm going to live and this person's going to be in my future, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and we have that all planned out. It's never happened. But we're grieving what's never happened. Quite strange, isn't it? Yeah? So when you really look at grief, you know, you can't grieve the past. You can't grieve the present. You really can't grieve the future, but we try to. It's interesting, isn't it? And we hardly ever think about the people we care about, you know, think about their lives from a Dharma viewpoint and care about them in that way. Because if we did, then we would encourage them to practice Dharma while they're alive. You know, so many people come to me and they say, how do I help my relative? You know, they died last week. How do I help them? And it's like, well, they're not here. You know, so you can make offerings on their behalf and offer their things to a charity, and you can make prayers and do pujas for them. But the real time to benefit the people you love is while they're alive. And how do you benefit them? You encourage them to be generous. You encourage them not to harm others, to, you know, abandon killing and stealing and unwise sexual conduct and harsh speech and lying and disharmony, and, you know, and you encourage them to be, you know, generous and patient and so on. But how much do we do that with the people that we're close to? Do we really encourage them to be virtuous? Or when they come to us and they're angry, we go, yeah, you have every right to be angry. That guy's a real jerk. Yeah. Or when they give something that belongs to the family away, we go, why did you do that? Now we won't have the money to go on vacation. Yeah? And we ask our dear ones to lie for us, to cover up for us. And yet after they die, then we say, how can I benefit them? Yeah, that doesn't make sense. Yeah, it's like mealtime's been over and you arrive late and you say, what can I eat? You know, that it's gone. Yeah. So really the time to benefit the people we care about is now. Yeah. In every moment, by encouraging them in virtue and discouraging them in non-virtue. Okay. So Aryadeva is saying, if you lament others' death but you ignore your own death, that doesn't make any sense. Okay, verse 13. If unrequested, someone has become your child, it is not unreasonable if he leaves without having asked. So somebody is saying, it's reasonable to grieve when one's child goes to the next world without asking. You know, and so the implication is that your child should at least be polite enough to ask you before they die. Yeah, they should ask permission to die. Stupid, isn't it? Yeah? But this is the way somebody's thinking, you know. Okay, it's reasonable, you know, if you know, to grieve one's child if they go without asking. But, you know, they should have asked. So, if someone you haven't requested to become your child, okay, does become your child through the force of their own karma, you didn't ask them to become your child. They just, because of karma, their karma and your karma became your child. Then what, you know, it's not unreasonable that for them to leave without asking permission either. It's cute, isn't it? You know, the kid didn't say, can I move in for 40 years? And, you know, and no, they don't ask permission, they move in. Yeah. And so they're going to move out without asking permission either. So it's the child's nature to come and go at will. We don't know where they come from or where they go to, do we? When you have a baby, you have no idea who that being is. It is such potluck. No idea. Where did this kid come from? What's this kid's karma? What did they just get done experiencing? You have no idea. And when they die, you have no idea where they're going either. You know? It's just, it really highlights the brief amount of time that you're in a parent-child relationship. And then it makes you think, considering that relationship is actually for such a brief amount of time, why do we have so much attachment in it? You know? I mean, usually if we know something's going to be very brief, we don't bother to invest a lot of emotional energy in it. Do we? You know? I mean, if you're living with someplace, if you're living in a hotel and you know you're only going to be there a day or two, you're not going to put a lot of energy into scrubbing the place and making it clean, you know, and getting to know all your neighbors, because you're saying, I'm only here for a short time. So actually, in the same way, when you look over how long samsara is and what a short time we're in that parent-child relationship, then it's kind of funny that we get so attached to something that's actually so fleeting. Okay. That doesn't mean that we don't appreciate our parents. Of course we appreciate our parents. But appreciating our parents, you know, and loving them in the Buddhist meaning of love, wanting them to have happiness and its causes, that those two things are very different than being attached to them. Okay, verse 14. Only because of your confusion, you didn't notice your child's indications that they were going to leave. His enthusiasm to go is shown by his growing old. Okay. So perhaps the issue isn't that he didn't ask you. It's that you didn't notice him aging. Okay. And so his enthusiasm, in quotes, to go to the next world is implicitly shown by the fact that he's aging. Okay. So it's unreasonable to be eager to produce a child, but to grieve his death, which is the result of his birth. Okay. So in other words, if you don't want to grieve your child's death, don't have a child. Because as soon as you have a child, you're setting yourself up for the grief of separating from that child. Because either they're going to die first or you're going to die first. Yeah. So this is the disadvantage of attachment. You know, if we can have children without being attached to them, then it's much better, you know. Our mind's much healthier, their mind's much healthier, the relationship is much healthier. Okay. But, you know, our children aren't going to ask permission to be born or to die. But the fact that they're aging indicates that they're going on to the next life, you know, before too long. I remember one of my mother's friends said it was so shocking for her when her daughter turned 65. You know, it wasn't so shocking that she was aging, but to think, I have a daughter who, you know, is going to go on Social Security now. How's that going to happen? Okay, verse 15. A child does not love her father as much as her father loves her. People in the world go down, thus a high rebirth is hard to find. Okay, so it's true. So here's the question that somebody says. Though, you know, my child showed enthusiasm to go because he was aging, great attachment to him causes us to grieve. You know? So Aryadeva says, well, attachment isn't appropriate. You know, why are you grieving? Because you're attached. You're not grieving because that person died. You're grieving because you're attached to them. Yeah? That's quite profound to think about, isn't it? Not grieving because that person died. We're grieving because we're attached. In other words, we don't have to have relationships that are sticky, gooey, bubblegum attachment to people. We can care about people without the attachment. Okay? So children have a weak sense of gratitude towards their parents. So it's no wonder that your child doesn't consider how much pain you're going to have when the child dies. Yeah. But attachment creates destructive karma, which leads to a lower rebirth. Yeah, so that gets into the last two lines. People in the world go down, thus a high rebirth is hard to find. So when we have attachment towards our child or towards anybody, yeah, then we're going to create a lot of harmful karma that will ripen in our own suffering. Okay? So it's appropriate to respect our elders. And I think that's very helpful to do. Because when we respect them, we can learn something from them. Yeah? And a lack of gratitude destroys our Dharma practice, actually. Because if we don't have a sense of gratitude and respect for others, then implicit in that is, I know everything and I'm the best person around, so why should I respect and have gratitude towards anybody else? Yeah. So if we're the best one around and we have that opinion of ourselves because we don't have gratitude and respect for others, then how are we ever going to learn? Because we think that we are already so sophisticated and knowledgeable and talented and advanced. Yeah? So that lack of gratitude actually destroys our Dharma practice, because humility is is an important quality of a Dharma practitioner. You know, when you look at the really good practitioners, they don't go around boasting of what they've done. I've done this retreat, I've realized this, I've taught that, I've done this, I, you know. No, they're quite humble. Quite humble. Okay? So a lack of gratitude destroys our practice, and that makes having a good rebirth hard to find. Okay? So attachment to an obedient or a disobedient child is really doesn't make much sense. Whether your child asks permission, may I die now? Or doesn't ask permission. You know, that's not the issue. Okay, verse 16. When he is disobedient, no one will call him lovable. In that case, attachment is nothing but a transaction. Okay, so no one calls a disobedient child lovable. Yeah. So the person says, you know, the one mouth, Kachik, says, but one is attached to an obedient child. Yeah. You know, the child who does everything you want them to do, it loves you so much, takes care of you, says please and thank you, and, you know, follows all your advice, then he's saying, but, you know, we're attached to those kind of kids. Okay, so Aryadeva says, then attachment is only a business transaction. In other words, I love you because you're obedient. Okay, and the attachment isn't due to the child. It's I love you if you're obedient, I don't love you if you're not obedient. So you're not really attached to the child, you're attached to the child doing what you want. Yeah, you're attached to your own happiness that you get from the child. So he's saying in that way that, you know, what your attachment is just a business transaction. You know, I'm attached to you or I love you because you are what I want you to be. And in Buddhism, we're really trying to grow beyond that. We're trying to grow beyond that checklist kind of fondness that comes from, you know, when you make me happy, when you please me, then I have good feelings about you. And when you don't please me, I can't stand you. Because this is the way of ordinary beings, isn't it? You know, and animals are like this too. You know, they wag their tail. Dogs wag their tail when somebody like them that they like comes, and they growl when somebody they don't like comes. And we human beings do that too. We have different ways of wagging our tail, you know, so to speak. So, you know, as Dharma practitioners, or just as human beings, we want to be able to do something that animals can't do. And I'm not talking about making atom bombs that animals can't make. That's not the kind of proper use of human intelligence. But to really use our human intelligence to see that attachment to some people and, you know, aversion or hatred towards other people is completely inappropriate. Yeah? And completely based on illogical reasons. It doesn't make any sense to be attached to the people that do what we want and to hate the people who do what we don't want. Because that really makes our emotions a business transaction. You know, you want me to love you? Do this, 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 this. Yeah? And if you don't do that, I don't care about you. And that's the way our self-centered mind is. It's true, isn't it? You know? Okay, then verse 17. Suffering caused by separation is quickly gone from human hearts. See, too, attachment's instability indicated by suffering's end. Okay, so then somebody says, a parent's attachment to their child is steadfast whether or not the child is obedient. In other words, I really love my kid, whether they obey me or don't obey me. Okay? That's what this person's thinking. So Aryadeva says, well, actually, you know, attachment isn't so steadfast. And grief doesn't last that long. Okay. Because if the bonds of attachment didn't loosen, the suffering it causes wouldn't cease. But because we do see people getting over the loss of a dear one, we know that the attachment can be released. Because people do heal from loss, don't they? Yeah, you lose your parents, you lose your dear ones, you lose your kid, you lose your dog or cat, you know, and people grieve so much, but then they get over it. Yeah, people are very resilient. Yeah, so the fact that grief doesn't last forever shows that the attachment to somebody doesn't last forever either. Because if we were consistently attached, then we would never get over the grief. Okay, but we do get over the grief, so the attachment isn't consistent. Yeah, you may miss somebody, yeah? But you go on living your life. Yeah. And there's other people that you become attached to, even though somebody that you cared for has passed away. Okay, so the suffering caused by separation is quickly gone from human hearts. Okay, grief doesn't last forever. So that means that attachment is also unstable. And that's indicated by the fact that the suffering from attachment ends. I was at a memorial service once. I was asked to do this memorial service. And it was the man of a couple. They were in their 30s when he died. They had been high school sweethearts. They had three kids. And he died of cancer at a young age. And she was like glowing at the memorial service. And she just said, all the love... Her husband's name was John. All the love you gave me, John, my heart is so full, and I'm going to go out and share it with everybody else. And she was really, she had this incredible expression on her face. And I thought, wow, she really has gotten it. She understands. Yeah. So verse 18, knowing it is of no benefit. Still you have injured yourself. You make yourself a hypocrite, which is also improper. Okay, so now somebody says, though it's not appropriate to feel pain at loss, so they've kind of now owned that attachment causes pain, so it's not appropriate to feel pain when I lose somebody. To meet social expectations, I must act like I'm grieving. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Because if I'm not grieving, if I'm not going hysterical, if I'm not beating my chest and saying, I can't live without this person, I'm overwhelmed, you know, then people will think I don't care about them. Yeah? So, this person who asks all these questions, they have really interesting ways of thinking, don't they? Yeah? So I have to do it according to societal expectations. You know, when I lived in Italy, I heard that sometimes when people die, they hire some people to walk behind and cry and wail to show how much they love the person who died. Yeah? Do they do that in Singapore?
Yes. Yeah, at Chinese funeral, you must cry very loud. The louder the better.
Yeah, you must cry loudly and wail and... And then you have the trucks beating the cymbals, and you know.
We had a brass band that played that only your mother is a good person on this earth, and my grandmother's funeral. Huge.
Yeah, you have to do this big display. Yeah. Okay. So, Aryadeva says, it's inappropriate to do that. Tearing your hair out and injuring yourself to show you're grieving is hypocrisy. Mm. Yeah. It's the way of the deceitful. In other words, you know, you're not just fulfilling societal expectations, you're being quite deceptive, and it's a type of lying, you know. So it's really kind of, again, rather nonsensical to make a big display of one's grief, you know, as if you're totally overwhelmed. Verse 19, people in this world wander, full, as it were, of suffering. Why fill with suffering people who already suffer? So, the person says, though self-torment isn't beneficial, okay, beating my brow and making this display of being so much upset isn't beneficial, you've got to do it to have a relationship with the surviving relatives. So it's not just all of society, it's the surviving relatives, you know. So I've always found that quite strange. Like, somebody may be dying, and you don't have to be there for their death, but you have to be there for their funeral. You know? It's interesting, isn't it? Yeah? Like, they didn't come to so-and-so's funeral. Yeah. But it was okay if they weren't there when that person died. When you would think that you would want the person there when the death is happening to, you know, ease the stress and say goodbye. But actually, you know, so much is involved when a family member dies with pleasing the surviving relatives. The death isn't just about the person who's dying. It's about the surviving relatives. Yeah? Okay. So then Aryadeva responds, through the force of attachment, ordinary beings continue to wander and be full of suffering. So all your relatives, you know, at the funeral, who are looking to see if you're wailing and everything, because they want to know that you're with them, those people already have so much suffering, and they're wandering all around in samsara due to their karma and afflictions. So why cause them more suffering by encouraging their attachment due to your show of grief? Okay, so when you wail and go hysterical, it's increasing other people's attachment, it's increasing other people's pain, and then they get more and more miserable too. Yeah. So Aryadeva says, since there's no use in having relationships with such people, put effort into the means to liberate yourself from samsara. Then our mind goes, but those are my family members, those are my dear ones. They're the only people that I have that I can rely on. I have to please them. I don't want to just leave and go off and, you know, do Dharma practice because these people are so precious to me. Right? Yeah? We've seen that for some people who come here to the Abbey, this is a huge issue. Huge, huge, huge. You know, they don't want to separate from their family and their loved ones. You know? Yeah. I mean, we've seen this many times in EML from people's comments and so on. Yeah? So Aryadeva is saying, you know, relationships with people like this that expect you to put on a show of grief, even though your show of grief is going to instigate more attachment and more misery in them, kind of, what do you need to have close relationships with people like that for? You know? So from a Dharma perspective, if your aim is liberation, if your aim is enlightenment, if you really want to get out of samsara, okay, purifying your own mind and actualizing the Dharma realizations is the most important thing you can do. So rather than hang around trying to please people that at the end of the day you can never please. They will never be pleased, no matter what tap dance you do. Yeah? Then go off and really seek the Dharma and do some serious practice. Yeah. But it's interesting, isn't it, how our mind feels so shocked when Aryadeva says that. Like, but, how can I leave these people? Yeah? And that reaction goes to show that we haven't understood anything of the first, 19 verses, or the first 18 verses, in which he's really saying, look, you're going to die and you're going to separate from these people, so pay attention to what's important. Yeah? That's what he's been saying the whole time. And we go, yes, 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 makes sense. But then when he says, kind of leave those relationships and really seek the Dharma, we go, but I can't do it. Interesting, isn't it? How deeply rooted that attachment is. Yeah? And I remember as a child thinking, why are people so attached to each other just because they share some genes? And they're blood relatives. I remember thinking that, like, I'm not my body. I'm not my body, so why am I so attached to people who have genes that are related to mine? Why? Yeah, if you think about it, why? Just because they have, same blood lineage, but I'm not my body, so what difference does it really make? So verse 20, if meeting is a joy to you, why is parting not also a joy? Do not meeting and parting both seem to go together? So here somebody says, though parting causes suffering, being with our dear ones brings happiness. Therefore, attachment to them is reasonable. And Aryadeva says, but meeting, coming together with them, coming together by taking birth in that family or meeting, for Sunday dinner, whatever it is, whatever kind of meeting it is, intrinsic to meeting is separation. Because whatever comes together has to separate. It cannot remain together all the time. Yeah? Because causes and conditions rule the game. Causes and conditions make things come together, they make things separate. Yeah? So he's saying, meeting and parting go together. So if the first is a joy to you, the second should also be a joy. Yeah? Since meeting and parting go together, if you like meeting your dear ones, you should also like parting from them. Okay? But all the pleasures of meeting are connected with the suffering of parting. Yeah? So the more pleasure you have at meeting, the more pleasure from attachment. Not just if you have Dharma pleasure or real pleasure because you have genuine love and you're really delighted to see someone, that's fine because you're not going to get all bummed out when you separate because you accept that you're coming together and you're going to separate. Yeah? But when we like love meeting with them, but we can't stand saying goodbye, then it's the same thing as we want to live long but we don't want to get old. One entails the other, and there's no way around it. Birth entails death. Meeting entails separation. Yeah? Death involves aging. Yeah? Verse 21. When the past is beginningless and the future endless, why do you notice being together, but not, though long, the separations? So somebody says the suffering of separation can be discounted because though parting is certain, the time spent together is long. No, I think it should be the suffering of separation can't be discounted because though parting is certain, the time spent together is long. Okay? So you spend so much time together that how can you discount the suffering of parting? That's what the guy's saying. So Aryadeva says, the periods of separation are long and the time together is short. In other words, the way you're thinking is wrong. Because we have beginningless previous lives, endless future lives until we liberate ourselves. So our time together in this life is actually very short. Yeah. So if we're attached to the short periods of being together, then we should be depressed by the long separation. Yeah. But, you know, we're actually not together with that person for a long time. We're not together for a long time. Very quickly, you know. They say that this life is like a flash of lightning, like a finger snap. Comes and goes. I mean, while it's happening, it feels so long. But however old you are, you know, doesn't it seem like the last X number of years have gone by very quickly?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, a year was a really long time. And now it's like 20 years is short. Yeah? I can remember so well 20 years ago. And the age I was 20 years ago, I really can't call exceedingly young either. You know? I mean, I'm 62. I can't. I mean, 40 is young, but I can't really say, you know, like it's really young. Yeah? Because there's always 20.
Right.
Yeah? No, 20's young. But actually, you know, when you're 20, there's a lot of water under the bridge already. Okay, so it doesn't make much sense to be attached to the short periods of time that we're together. Okay, by thinking that actually they're long periods of time, therefore it's fine to be attached. Yeah, that's not reasonable. In verse 22, time consisting of instants and so forth is certainly like an enemy. Therefore, never be attached to that which is your enemy. So someone says, though separations are long, the suffering of separation vanishes when the mind is distracted by the marvels of the seasons. Okay, so before this person was saying, the suffering of separation can be discounted because though parting is certain, we spent together a long time, you know. So that's what in 21, you know, the suffering of separation can be discounted because you spent so much time together that was a really long time. So that was refuted by saying, no, it was actually a short time that you spent together. Yeah. And then here, the person saying, okay, though the separation is long, the suffering of separation vanishes when the mind's distracted by the marvels of the seasons. And it doesn't have to be the marvels of the seasons. You know, it could be just the marvels of samsara. We're distracted by some other pleasure. So then the suffering of separation doesn't seem so bad. Okay? So Aryadeva says, if you don't leave your loved ones and do sincere practice due to fear of being separated from them, then the Lord of Death will certainly separate you from them. So if you don't leave your loved ones because you see the Dharma as the most important thing, and you realize this is an incredibly precious opportunity to attain liberation that doesn't last very long, and you had to do so much in previous lives to create all the causes and conditions to get this kind of life with this kind of opportunity. Yeah? So seeing that, if you don't leave your loved ones and do sincere practice, well, the Lord of Death is going to make you separate from your loved ones anyway. Yeah? So you're going to separate from them anyway, but you won't even have had you won't have done any practice when you're separating from them. Okay? So what he's saying is you're still going to lose out by separating from the people you care about. So given that you're going to separate from them anyway, shouldn't you do some Dharma practice and have some virtue and some purification under your belt when you die? You know, instead of just throwing up your hands at the time of death saying, woe is me, you know, I thought death wasn't going to come to me and I'm so attached to my relatives and now I'm separating and, you know, what's going to happen? That must be really painful. Really painful. Yeah. And I think especially if somebody knows the Dharma and had the chance to practice and then really gave that up out of some reason, you know, out of attachment to somebody, and then at the time of death you go, oh my goodness, what did I do? You know, because you realize you can't take that person with you, you can't take any of this life stuff with you. But because of attachment to all of that, you didn't do the Dharma, and now you're going to have to go on with a mind that is not purified and not well-trained and not developed, and there must be so much regret at that time. So much regret. Yeah. So someone who is wise will not wait until the Lord of Death forces him to do something that he knows he has to do anyway. So if we know we're going to have to separate from our loved ones anyway, why wait for the Lord of Death to do it? Yeah. So he's saying go to, you know, where you can do serious Dharma practice and make an effort to attain liberation before death, you know, threatens you with its quote-unquote punishment, meaning that you're dying with very little good karma and a lot of negativity. Yeah. So Aryadeva is saying this to us out of great compassion. But sometimes our negative mind goes, he's just too much, this is too radical, this is unreasonable. It's unreasonable. How can I leave my family? What this guy is saying is totally stupid and unreasonable. There's got to be a middle way. That's what we say, you know, when we have a lot of attachment. Yeah? Because we don't understand what samsara is. Yeah? We have no wisdom about the danger of remaining in samsara. Yeah? We're just taking it as it comes without any understanding of what samsara is and what causes it and how to get out of it and what's important in our life and how precious this opportunity is. Yeah. In fact, we look and say, well, what's so special about a human life? It's no big deal. There's 7 billion of us. Nothing special about a human life. And then people say, you know, my life is worthless, and they get depressed. Yeah, my life is so worthless, so useless, I can't do anything. And that's not true at all, you know, and it's such a tragedy when they can't see the meaning and value and purpose in their life, but just kind of get depressed over, you know, oh, it's all suffering, it's all pain, it has no meaning at all. I mean, that mind state is so painful. And it's so unnecessary and so incorrect. Verse 24, you may think you must obviously go to the forest, in other words, go to practice the Dharma, once this has been done. Whatever you do must be left behind. What is the value of having done it? So this person says, though we must certainly leave our dear ones, we really can only go.
23, we didn't do
23. Oh, yes, you're right, 23. Fool, because you fear separation, you do not leave home. Who that is wise does not understand punishment? What must certainly be done? Okay, so here the person is saying, though what was said before is reasonable, separating from our loved ones is so hard to do. And so fearing that, I really can't go off to practice the Dharma. Because it's just too hard. It's too much suffering to leave my loved ones. It's too much suffering for me. It's too much suffering for them. They will be overwhelmed by grief. You know, I can't do that to them for the sake of Dharma. Right? Mm-hmm. We hear this, yeah? We might say it. So the response, Aryadeva says, if you don't leave your loved ones and do sincere practice due to fear of being separated from them, the Lord of Death will certainly separate you from them. Okay? So someone who's wise won't wait until the Lord of Death forces the separation. Actually, you know what I did? When I did verse 22, I did the explanation for 23. Let me go back. Verse 22, okay, the person saying, though the separation is long, the suffering of separation vanishes when the mind's distracted. Okay. So the answer to that is, time consists of brief moments that add up and consume the time you have to live. So time is the enemy that robs us of our life. What is the use of being attached to our enemy? Okay? So if you're saying that, you know, you're distracted by the marvels of the seasons, you know, because time is passing and this new thing comes and that new thing comes, then Aryadeva is saying, you know, to see time as your friend, that's going to bring you new things to get attached to and new things to get distracted to, is not very wise, because, you know, time is what actually robs us of our life. Time is what brings aging and death. So why are you attached to your enemy? Okay. Then verse 23, fool, because you fear separation, you don't leave home. Who that is wise does under punishment what certainly must be done. So why wait for the Lord of Death to, quote, quote, punish you when you know you have to separate from your loved ones at some time? Why not do it sooner so you have the time to practice the Dharma, so when you die, you have some Dharma wealth to die with? Okay. So then the person says, okay, though we, you know, well, 20 verse 24 says, you may think you obviously go to the forest, in other words, do serious practice, once this has been done. Whatever you do must be left behind. What is the value of having done it? So here somebody says, okay, though we must certainly leave our dear ones, we can only go to practice Dharma after we've brought up our children and handed over all the responsibilities to the family, of the family to them. Okay? So, okay, you know, certainly we've got to leave them, but not now. You know, first I have to raise my children, I have to get the family business on good solid ground, I have to make sure my kids get married, and I have to make sure they have kids, and I have to make sure that I get my awards and my trophies, and, you know, that I get this and that and the other thing, and that the family is all secure, and then I'll go practice the Dharma. Okay, because this was often in ancient India, you know, you saw your life in different phases of life. So, you know, as an adult, your responsibility was to the family and raising the children and securing the family financial. And only in your old age did you have the freedom to go off and practice. Yeah? So that's what this person's saying. Yeah, mañana I'll do it. Okay. And Aryadeva says, you may think that later you must certainly practice, but only after bringing up your children. But whatever you do must inevitably be left behind. Yeah. So all these things that you're wanting to do first before you go to practice, you're going to have to leave all those things behind. So what's the value of having done that which doesn't yield even the slightest desirable result? It's better to give it up from the start. Okay. So, I can't leave yet because I really have to make the family financially secure. When is the family ever going to be financially secure? Never. Yeah. I can't leave because I've got to take care of my kids and take care of this one and take care of that one. When is taking care of other people ever going to end? It's not, is it? You know, you take care of one relative, eventually they die, then you take care of another one comes along, you know? And so you wind up consistently, you know, I have to work a little bit longer, I have to take care of one more person, you know, I'm about to, you know, finally get my Social Security that I've been paying into. I want to at least, you know, get something out of what I've given the government. You know, all these things that people think. And Aryadeva is saying, you know, all this stuff you're going to have to separate from anyway. So why are you hanging on to it now? Yeah. Why are you hanging on to a lead ball that you're dragging around that's preventing you from enriching your mind with the Dharma and purifying your negativities? Okay, so we're out of time. So we will finish up with verse 25, the last one in the first chapter, next week, and then start the second chapter.
Now, mm-hmm. What are the questions? Where is that commentary where the question came from?
That's Gelsenjai. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Gelsenjai wrote a commentary to Aryadeva's text. So the book, Yogic Deeds of Bodhisattvas, that has Gelsenjai's commentary in it. Yeah. He was one of Jay Rinpoche's two foremost disciples. So I think lots to think about here, huh? Mm-hmm. Okay. And especially this last bit, this feeling that, but if I leave to go do serious Dharma practice, the world's going to stop. Everybody's going to fall apart without me. You know, I can't. And it's like, actually, you know, the world's going to keep spinning, even if you go do Dharma practice, because anyway, you're going to die at some time, and you have no control over that. So might as well separate now for a virtuous reason and do something good with your life, rather than dragging it on and on and on, and have the Lord of Death force the separation.
But I start to think like that. You need to really believe in awakening that you can get out of this samsara.
Yeah.
But if you don't have that in mind.
Yeah, right. But that's why he's teaching this. And that's why the first verse in the text isn't, you know, emptiness and the union of bliss and void. And it's this. So that we really begin to think about, you know, what is important in our life and what are we doing. Yeah. And that's why, I mean, these teachings are very strong, but Aryadeva is saying all of this to us with compassion so that we can make our lives meaningful. What does he have to gain from us going off to practice the Dharma? Nothing. Yeah. What does he have to gain from us giving up attachment? Nothing. Yeah. He's saying this because out of affection and care and compassion for us.
I got again triggered when you said something about not having kids. I don't know why at EML I get triggered too when you talk about family not having kids. I don't know what it is, but there's a part of me that gets...
Oh, that gets triggered?
Yeah.
Yeah, because somehow you're holding that having kids is important?
What I remember was I said, well, the people are going to come from.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't have to worry about that.
That's exactly what you answered.
Yeah. Yeah. You know.
I don't know what it is. But anyway.
Yeah.
When I hear this strong talking about death and how important it is to practice the Dharma, I have to be really careful with my mind that I don't go too far over where I start thinking I don't have enough time and I met it too late. So I really, I pull myself into that place.
That it's easy to say, okay, but I'm living here in a monastery, but I don't have enough time to meditate, and I don't have enough time to study. And I really, you know, I should really go further out in the woods and really do some serious practice. And the mind gets all turned up and, you know, about that. Yeah. And then to ask ourselves, okay, if I really want to go and do serious practice, don't I have to make adequate preparation so that the time when I do that is going to be worthwhile? Yes. Have I made adequate preparation? Can I control my mind and work with my mind to meditate, that many hours a day? Have I studied enough so that my meditation is going to be really meaningful? You know, have I done enough purification so that I'm not going to be, you know, just scattered all over the place? Yeah. So you have to keep that same fervor. But the fervor isn't for going and living in a cave and meditating. The fervor is for practicing the Dharma.
I don't think so much that it's about that I should go up to the hills or somewhere. It's more just, maybe it's more about all the time I wasted, I guess.
That's what I was going to say. That actually what we should do is be more attentive and not waste so much time. And make sure that we do things with a good motivation, you know, and not just fritter away our time. You know, that's if we really want to take what he's saying to heart, you know, while we're creating the causes to do serious practice, you know, to make our time now as serious as we possibly can. And by serious, I don't mean straight face like that, but I mean to really engage in the Dharma and not just, you know, hang around and talk and go here and there and all the reasons I really have to go to Spokane 5 times a week and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I was also thinking, just set the infrastructure, for example, setting up an abbey for future monasteries and so on. It's also a way of practicing the Dharma because you're going and getting a lot of merit and people who support the abbey, they set their own future.
Right, so. Right. That what we're doing in setting up an abbey, you know, for the benefit of the existence of the Dharma and the benefit of all the people that are going to come here in the future, you know, that kind of motivation is a tremendous motivation that's going to create a lot of merit. Yeah. Even if you're, you know, involved in what kind of door do we want, and where, you know, we've got to dig the hole for the pipe a little bit more this direction and not that direction. The whole reason for doing it, yeah, isn't a reason of toil. It's a reason of joy, you know, because we're working for a purpose that goes way, way, way beyond our own self-centeredness, you know. And that is really going to be beneficial to others and is going to benefit them in a Dharma way. Not just even in a worldly way, but especially in a Dharma way. so that people can come here and really learn and practice. And so everything we're doing, you know, because we have to do lots of small things to make an abbey. It isn't like making an abbey is one big thing. Da 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 da! I made an abbey. It's many, many small things, isn't it? It's this email and that email and that, you know, piece of Foswall and this bolt and, yeah, it's all those things. And this meeting and this whatever it is. Yeah, so it's just doing the whole big thing is just an accumulation of small things. And so to make all the small things we're doing an act of love and compassion for sentient beings. Yeah, and so that's the whole idea behind offering service. Yeah, and if we're doing whatever our thing is at the Abbey and feeling its drudgery, then we've lost our motivation and we need to go back. And it's like, you know, think about the beautiful karma we're creating by offering service and building an abbey. And not just doing that, but all the study that we do and the practice that we do. Because it's not, we're not building an abbey by building buildings, you know, because the buildings, I mean, they could sell this property and make it into a cowboy ranch. And then, of course, they'll have to, they'll serve meat and they'll have to get a different fan for the kitchen room. Okay. But the way we're building the Abbey is through keeping the schedule and setting up a way of practice here so that when people come, they slide into the energy, they slide into the way of practice here. You know, and we're the ones who are holding that energy, who are holding, yeah, we meditate twice a day and we offer service and we do chanting and we do stop and, you know, create our motivation and we do stop and check our mind. And, you know, so by us doing that together as a group, that's creating the Abbey, you know. But to do it as a group, we each have to do it individually. So it's not just about, you know, building buildings. It's about our, the small things we do day to day that create a Dharma practice, our own personal Dharma practice, and the group Dharma practice that sets up the conditions so that when other people come here, they have something to slide into and fit into. You know, when you and you come, you don't go, okay, what do I do? You know, what's Dharma? What do I do? I don't know what to do. Can I wake up whenever I want? You know, it's like you come here and you know what to do and you slide into it because there's a container for it. Yeah. So, you know, our own personal practice, which is part of the group practice, also is, I mean, that's the really important part of creating the Abbey. And the way we hold the precepts, yeah, so that people know when you come here, this is how you live, you know, and you don't bring any dope and alcohol, yeah, and you don't, you know, and your cell phone gets put in the safe, and you're going to be with real live people, and you're going to hear Dharma, and you're going to get up early, and, you know, these kinds of things, so that other people have the opportunity to really learn and experience the Dharma. Okay, so that is also, that's the really big part of doing it. And then learning the Dharma, so when people come, we can answer questions. Yeah. Or we can say, you know, I don't know, and then we go look it up. Okay. But all that is creating the monastery and all that is serving sentient beings. It's true,
it's not,
isn't it?
And it's not... The part that is I'm starting to understand is that all the worldly, mundane things are worldly because of the motivation. By changing the motivation, every worldly thing becomes a merit-gathering, bodhicitta-cultivating, awakening, cooperative condition. You know, it's not like we had to make something different. We just took what we had and do it in a different way with a different kind of mind.
Yeah, yeah.
I had so much magical thinking when I came here.
Yeah.
I really thought it was going to be something else, and I'm so glad it's not. I'm so glad it is what it is.
Yeah.
But it takes some getting used to doing that with a different mind.
Yeah. Okay, shall we dedicate?
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losong's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Guratna mandala kamdiryataya me. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born of no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Florida.